Class 3 of the World Peace Diet Facilitator Circle. I'm your host, Steve Prusak, and tonight we'll be joined by Dr. Will Tuttle and his special guest, Harold Brown. We'd like to welcome all the new students currently enrolled in the Mastery in Facilitator Training Program. You'll receive a new course module each week. If you need any tech support, just send us an email at info@worldpeacemastery.com, and we'll be back to you within a few hours. To let everyone know, the community forums are now fully functional. There were some login problems for a while there. It's all been resolved. Just be sure to use your username when you log in, not your email address, your username, and join us. It's embedded directly in the membership site now, so you don't have to go off the website to access those. We are no longer using the old boards, so if you're still bookmarked to go to the old boards, we suggest you delete that. Every time you need to go to the forums, log into the membership site, click on the button that says Community Forum, and you'll be directly right in the forums. So join us now. Stay connected. It's the best way to keep the circle going. And right now, I'd like to introduce to you the author of The World Peace Diet and visionary artist behind our virtual programs. Let's welcome back Dr. Will Tuttle. Hey, Will.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for the work you've been doing to help keep us all connected. And I hope everyone can hear me okay. It's a delight to be back on this call, again, our monthly call, where we can share our joys and concerns and our ideas and inspirations, as well as talk about the developments and so forth that are happening in the world of raising consciousness about living a life of compassion for all life, promoting the vegan message, and also thriving as vegans and becoming more effective as advocates for veganism and for really a world that works for everyone. So I'd like to, as Steve said, you know, just inform everyone that we are planning on being joined this evening by Harold Brown, also known as Farmer Brown, and he's in upstate New York, and we'll be also hearing from a few other folks, I think, during the call as well, who have some news to share and some ideas and so forth. And I'd like to begin by maybe just, again, just taking a minute here and inviting us to just very briefly pause and turn our attention within and just feel our connection with the Earth, this beautiful planet that supports all life here, the loving, nurturing energy that is flowing through all manifestations of life, including our own physical bodies and our spirits and minds and hearts. Feel our connection with each other, the beauty of the aspiration that we have to be part of an awakening of human consciousness on this planet, to remember that we are not alone, that there are many, many of our brothers and sisters who are also awakening and who will be awakening in the unfoldment of time, that really our mission is already accomplished in the big picture. And we're simply going through the efforts to manifest what is inevitable, which is a world that reflects the truth of the interconnectedness of all life, that there is love at the very core of our beings, wisdom and compassion, joy, freedom and peace. These are our true nature and are undeniable, and that the beings that we share this beautiful earth with, not only the other humans, but the other expressions of divine life or infinite life force, animals, are inherently free. And we see them as free, as perfect expressions of infinite life. And we give thanks for all the activists who are working, and at a deeper level, for all the people who are working on evolving their spiritual consciousness or their daily life consciousness to be in harmony with spiritual reality, that is the truth that we are. Great. So we give thanks, knowing that all the ripples that radiate from our being together on this call this evening will be to bring healing and peace and love and joy and freedom into our world for the benefit of all beings of the past, present, and future. And so I'd like to go ahead and just thank you all for being here. And I think we'll just go ahead and move into the main part of the beginning of the call, which will be to talk about some of the inherent issues within the vegan movement as it is unfolding right now. And we are joined, I see, by Harold Brown. He is with us. And so I just want to say, share a little bit about Harold's background and talk a little bit about him before we hear from him directly. And I think all of you actually got a copy of the email that Steve sent out where I talked a little bit about Harold's background and so forth. But he's a longtime farmer and rancher. He's called Farmer Brown, actually, and worked, you know, in that capacity for many years, born into it, as many farmers are. And at one point, if you've seen the movie Peaceful Kingdom or the new version, Peaceful Kingdom and Journey Home, you get a sense of how Harold experienced an awakening, and really on many levels that brought him really to question the underlying assumptions of animal agriculture, agriculture in general in our culture. And in my perspective, he's one of the foremost people speaking from experience about animal agriculture and also about some of our ways of trying to make positive changes. And he worked for years with Farm Sanctuary. He left Farm Sanctuary and now works more independently. He started his own organization called Farm Kind. He also works quite a bit with the HumaneMyth.org website and the Humane Myth work with Tribe of Heart people, James Levesque and Jenny Stein, to help expose the myth that there's such a thing as humane meat and humane dairy. And he's also very knowledgeable about permaculture and specifically veganic permaculture, veganic agriculture, which I think is extremely important myself. And a couple of years ago, Madeline and I had the opportunity to travel through the state of Iowa with Harold for, I can't remember how long it was, a good week, I think, and doing a number of lectures together. And so it was really very helpful to me to learn all I could from Harold. He's really a fountain of information with a deep understanding of the agricultural business in this country from the point of view of farmers, which a lot of us really don't have that kind of experience. So it's, I think, a great resource to be able to talk to him and listen to him speak to us. And so he's with us from his home in upstate New York. And so I'd like to go ahead and welcome to our call Farmer Brown. Harold, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me this evening.
Well, great. Thank you so much. We're all honored that you're with us. And I would just, I guess, like to maybe just start out by saying that pretty much everybody on the call is really interested in being effective as vegan advocates, and also to, you know, in our own lives, to, as best we can, not only live it successfully, veganism successfully ourselves, but to be able to be part of a movement that's really working to make a better world. And so I guess I'll just jump right in. What do you think the most important thing people can do to help spread the vegan message? And what do you think the vegan movement as a whole right now could be doing better, in your opinion?
Well, I would say that I guess I bring a different perspective to this topic within the movement, because I spent over half my life in that business, and, you know, for part of it, the latter part of it, watching animal advocacy from the other side of the fence, literally. And
yeah.
I basically felt that, and to a large extent I still believe that, a lot of what's going on in the animal movement is really ineffective. It's not going to create any kind of societal change because of the message that they have to share. And that's not to, you know, denigrate what anybody is trying to do. It's just that we're on the crest of a wave of a paradigm shift. And I think not just as a movement, but I think culturally and in this world, I think people are looking for a new way of relating to the stories that that they've lived with for so long, either personally or culturally. And basically what my observation was is that the movement, I mean, what for 30 years, well, let's say arguably that the movement has been active to a kind of an upswing of a cyclic momentum for about 30 years in the United States. And in 30 years, just how much has been accomplished for the sake of animals. And I would say that the biggest problem was that the message was it was a message that people didn't have the ears to hear, the eyes to see. And why is that? It's because the content of what people, what was being shared, were the very things that, by our very nature as human beings, try to keep out of our lives, every moment of our lives. And that's, those are such things as suffering and pain and misery. And, you know, these are things that we try so hard as creatures of leisure to keep out of our lives. Nobody, unless you're a sadomasochist, embraces, you know, and welcomes these things into your life as, you know, a matter of course. So we are like any other being on this planet, in that we relate better to things that are positive and good and bring us comfort and we find pleasure in. And I think this is where the movement needs to start focusing on. I think Jonathan Balcom, in his book, Pleasurable Kingdom, puts it best. I know Jonathan fairly well, and it's interesting in that there's tomes and reams written from an academic level on about the pain and suffering of animals. But there has been no empirical research done until Jonathan Balcom came along. There was absolutely no one who did any empirical research on what do animals find pleasurable in their lives. What are the things that they like? What are the things that they just personally or as a group or as a community or as a species as a whole find that gives them, you know, kind of
right.
their purpose in life. And I think this is part of that new movement, in that, you know, it's something that I think there's been a sensibility toward in certain traditions like maybe Hinduism or Buddhism or Taoism or Jainism, but it's not something that the Abrahamic traditions have ever embraced. And our whole academic, I mean, coming from a land-grant college background, you pick up any animal science book, or back in my day they were called animal husbandry books, you pick them up and they don't ever talk about what animals desire. It's about you know, what they can withstand for the sake of profit.
Wow.
And I think this is where we need to move. I think it's a time where if we want to relate to people, it's like the old story. You go into a room and there's a group of people to your right who are debating politics and religion. And to your left, there's a group of people playing music and games and laughing and singing. When you walk into the room, which way do you gravitate? You tend to gravitate towards the fun stuff. Well, we have to be those people. It's kind of the Gandhian idea of be the change you want to see in the world. Well, we have to be this moral and ethical example, but at the same time, it's got to be something that people are drawn to and that we invite them to, and not, you know, just, you know, expound ad nauseum about everything we know about whether it's environmental impacts or health consequences or the misery of animals. You know, we all have that knowledge, or many of us do, but those are the things that, you know, just, you know, people don't tend to, you know, really jump into that with both feet and say, you know, I understand, I'm on board with that. You know, we have to nurture them along. It's just that, I guess the bottom line is that my observation has been is that the activists as a whole have been very poor students of human nature, and that at its very core, the animal movement needs to see itself as a social justice movement. I've said this for years, that we need to see ourselves as a social justice movement, not unlike any other social justice movement. But the biggest challenge is we're advocating for a group that cannot speak for themselves. And that's what makes this very unique from any other social justice movement. But until we move into this way of thinking that it's a social justice movement, and it's something that we have to culturally invite everybody that's basically in the Abrahamic tradition or in the herding culture to say, look, come join us. It's going to be, you know, we're kind of spinning our wheels. But I'll tell you, since I've changed my tact on this and over the years, and I've learned through the School of Hard Knocks about how to deal with this, and I know Will is, in his book, is, you know, really tapped into this idea. It's creating change, you know, in leaps and bounds. And I really see this as the direction we need to move in.
Yeah. What do you think the role of sort of the MDs who are promoting plant-based diets for health reasons in the big picture of creating a vegan world?
Oh, it's huge. And I mean, you're seeing now, as a matter of fact, I just saw a documentary 2 days ago. It's a brand new documentary. It's called Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. And this is a guy from Australia. He's a venture capitalist from Australia who made this documentary about his journey and the journeys of others as he went through the United States, sharing this idea of turning his life around through juice fasting. And it's Dr. Joel Fuhrman is in it, which was kind of surprising.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about this, but I, you know, it was like there's more and more people because of the crisis. Again, this comes back to human nature. People don't tend to pay attention until they get hit upside the head with a 2x4, and it's these crises are opportunities. It's like kind of the old Chinese philosophy that chaos is, the Chinese view chaos as opportunity. We see in our culture, we see chaos as the end of things. You know, it's like, oh my God, it's all falling apart. But in other cultures, they see chaos as an opportunity, and that's what we should be seeing this. Is that this terrible place that we're culturally in with obesity and diabetes and heart disease and cancer, these are teaching moments for us. But we have to do it in the right way. But we have to show up in people's lives, and that's a lot of work. And it's this, again, is this kind of new paradigm, I think, that we have as activists, in that I use this, for me, a lot of things come back to metaphors and agriculture, but I think I see all people in whatever they're, you know, good they're trying to do in the world as being what I call farmers of compassion. And whenever you have a person that is in a bad place, when they're standing in front of you, you don't see them, I don't look at them as being a bad person or a person that needs to be changed. And it could be like a person who's doing absolutely horrible things to animals. You know, because every time I see that, I just think, you know, there, but for the grace of God, I was. That was me 20 years ago. So I can't make any judgments about that person. I don't have the right to make those judgments. So I look at these people as fertile ground. And my obligation, my responsibility is to plant seeds. And those seeds might be about health. If their crisis is a health crisis, then I'll plant what seeds, you know, very carefully. I'll pick those seeds very carefully. I know Howard Lyman taught me this a few years ago. He said that psychological studies have shown that you only have about 15 to 20 second window of engaging somebody in conversation, but you watch their eyes and you'll see them disengage for what you have to say. And when that happens, you know, you've lost them. And I've actually done this to where I've watched somebody and I'm talking and then I'll literally quit in mid-sentence and they didn't know I quit talking. They are that, they just shut down. But they're being polite and they're nodding their head and smiling, but you see it in their eyes. They're not there with you. So
Yeah. You got a kind of a faraway look all of a sudden.
Yeah. Right. The thing is you know, that 15-second window you have, you have to really listen to what their needs are and forget about your wants. What are their needs? And then speak directly to that need the best you can and in a compassionate and empathetic way. And, you know, and then when you have to really go by your intuition, when you feel that they've absorbed as many, you know, you've planted as many seeds in that soil as you can, you stop and then have patience. It's just like when you plant seeds in the ground, for a growing season, you have to be patient. You can't make them grow faster. You can't make them germinate faster than they're going to germinate. But your job at that point, my job at that point, is to, you know, provide, is to nurture, create the environment for those seeds to prosper. And that is to, you know, provide gentle sunshine and gentle rains, you know, to give those seeds what they need in their due course so that they'll thrive. And that's how I look at people. And sometimes it happens in a week. Sometimes it happens in 3 years. I've seen it, but it eventually does happen. But it's when we get frustrated and impatient, that's when things fall apart because then we disconnect from them. And that's the worst thing we can do.
Right. Wow, that's really beautifully said. I appreciate your saying that. It makes me feel even more strongly the importance of the work we're doing here with the World Peace Diet Facilitator groups and trying to create contexts of community where people don't feel alone, where they can, you know, in a sort of a support group setting or one-on-one setting, they can have their questions answered and be able to move toward a more plant-based diet and be supported in that. And I wonder, do you feel then that should be the main focus of what we do in terms of what we're doing to try to, you know, bring this message as opposed to, say, passing legislation that improves the welfare of the animals and so forth?
Yeah, I do, because any great change that's ever happened in the world has happened from the bottom up, not from the top down. You can't legislate morality. You can't legislate ethical behavior. I mean, you can create laws, but that's the problem. Who's going to enforce it? Who is going to be the gatekeeper for that? Yeah, it just can't happen. And especially when you're dealing with such a strong mythos that we do in this country and with our herding culture, you're not going to be able, from top down, to get people to stop using animals. That new way of thinking, this new context of how animals show up in the world so that they live on their own terms is not something that's going to happen through legislation. I mean, let me put it this way. There are people out there that are doing, I don't even call it welfare. I call it animal husbandry reform, because if you think about what does the word welfare mean, it means in the best interest of. Well, anything that they're doing, and I don't care if it's an animal advocacy organization, or if it is a land-grant college, or if it's national pork producers, it doesn't matter. They all say what they're doing is welfare, but what all of them they're doing, what each of those groups are doing and those people are doing, is not in the best interest of the animal. It's in the best interest of business. And that's why I say we shouldn't, I think to have integrity in what we do and how we show up in the world, and to have integrity on behalf of the animals, of non-humans, then we shouldn't be talking, say, what is going on is welfare. Call it by its proper name. Which is animal husbandry reform. And
right.
Also, like you mentioned before, you can't call any of this stuff humane. I mean, the definition of the word humane is just framed by three words, which is kindness, compassion, and mercy. And I've raised animals for 4-H and so on that, you know, they're like pets. But you can raise an animal, a farm animal, or you can take in a wild animal that's orphaned, and you can raise them kindly and compassionately. But when, especially with farm animals, when do we ever show them mercy? We never. They all die, and they all die prematurely. But the point is they all die at a time of our determining. So that's not humane in any, I mean, you just, there's no stretch of the imagination. You can call anything it's done to farm animals as being humane. So I think we need to get our language right when we talk about these things. And that's not to cast aspersions upon people who do this work. I mean, the organizations that advocate for, you know, animal husbandry reform, you know, God bless them. You know, if they can make things a little bit better for the 42 days and change that a broiler chicken is alive, then, you know, God bless them. But make no mistake and do not have any delusion that their life, that is any kind of step toward the liberation and any sort of justice for these mm-hmm. beings, because it's not. I don't see that it would lead that way. I mean, you can't find a parallel in any social justice movement where that ever worked either. So I think that we ought to be, you know, clear in our thinking and, you know, and call things by their true names. And I would, you know, use this at this point, I would say that it's just like Will has said, that when there's two ways of talking about how people are showing up in the world. If they're doing welfare work, and this is my opinion, but when people are doing welfare work and saying this is my passion, but at the same time call themselves vegan, that is a disparity. Because veganism is, Donald Watson described it, and how it's manifesting itself today is a moral and ethical way of showing up in the world. And it's actually the baseline. It's the floor of how we conduct ourselves in the world.
Right.
And we aspire to higher and greater things. But when you are basically what I call it, are involved in the pain management of farm animals, and you're just negotiating for a few more inches of cage space, or that, you know, you're saying, as long as they, I mean, none of these legislative things are a ban. I mean, when you look at the language and read the legislative bills, the word ban does not exist in any of the legislation. It only calls for three things: that an animal has enough room to lie down, stretch its limbs, and turn around. Well, those three things can be provided for in a larger cage. And that's so we have to, you know, realize exactly what is being worked for here. And if people want to do that, fine. If I wanted to have work in that area, I would have stayed a farmer because that's what I did. I grew up on a small farm and what many today would call a humane farm. But I'll tell you, it's when you go to a sanctuary and you see these animals that have been rescued and you hear their stories, you know, these incredibly sad stories of their circumstances, keep in mind that over 95%, if not 99%, of all those animals in sanctuaries came from small farms, not industrialized agricultural operations or CAFOs. So it's, but they don't tell you that. And it's, in many cases, in small farms, especially in dairy, the organic small dairy is a much worse circumstance for a cow than it is for in a large industrialized milking operation.
So, and why is that? Because are they actually treated with more cruelty in the small operation, you think?
Well, let's put it this way. It's they may have access, and here's the sticky word when you look at the USDA, and anybody can read this on the USDA website, about organic animal agriculture and what the organic standards call for. But the only thing that when you call a dairy product organic, all that means is that the animal is given 100% organic feedstuff and that no pharmaceuticals are used, period,
right.
None at all. And therefore, that makes the mammary excretion organic. Well, think about that for a moment. I mean, this is where critical thinking comes in. And I've talked to veterinarians, especially in Vermont, who specialize in organic dairy, and they say, you know, it's just a horror show. Think of it this way. You have a cow, and what the most prevalent problem with cows in the United States, and nearly every herd has it, I'd say every herd, at least subclinically, has a problem called mastitis. It's a bacterial infection of the udder. And what happens is this infection will manifest itself in one or all four quadrants of the udder, and it will plug up the teat. And there's, in most farms, what they will do, in non-organic farms, what they do is give them subclinical antibiotics, or subtherapeutic antibiotics in their feed or water to stave off the mastitis. Not that it gets rid of it, but it keeps it beat down enough so that you can keep milking the cow, that she'll still produce milk. But
right.
This is also why the allowable limit of what they call somatic cell counts in dairy is so high. Now, albeit with pasteurization, they're dead pus cells, but they're pus cells nonetheless, are allowed in milk, and it's because of mastitis. It's so widespread. And when dairy people tell you, oh, it's not that big a deal, well, go online and just Google mastitis and see what in the first 10 things you get on Google that come up. One of them is going to be the National Mastitis Council. If it wasn't that big of a problem, would they have their own website and their whole a whole institution devoted to fighting mastitis? But getting back to organic, the problem there is since you've precluded using any kind of pharmaceutical, you cannot use subtherapeutics on them, period. So when a cow gets mastitis, and she will, you keep milking her until she plugs up. And it's extremely painful. And the one course thing you can do to keep her milking for a while is there's a, I forgot what it's called now. But it looks like a long stainless steel corkscrew. It's about 3 or 4 inches long, and it's very, very small. The diameter of the turn of this corkscrew is probably less than a quarter of an inch. But you take
right.
the plugged up teat, and you screw it up in there, and then just rip it out, and that opens up the teat. They'll bleed for a while, but you put a little iodine on them, and you wait a day, and then you can keep milking them. But you can only do that a couple times before the infection sets back into the mammary gland to the point where she's not going to be able to produce and just backs up. She starts to swell. and then they'll get an infection, which will eventually kill them. So when they do get mastitis and they start plugging up badly, those cows are sent off to auction to be slaughtered. So they, you know, they suffer without veterinary care, because why would you call a veterinarian? Because you can't. The veterinarian can't give them anything. So that's the problem with organic dairy.
So the organic, they suffer more because they can't give them any antibiotics, and the mastitis is very painful.
Or anything else. If they get, if they get like a serious hoof infection or, you know, a fly strike or any of these other, you know, parasitic problems, you can't treat them, you know, with what other cows. You can treat them with, like, you know, these insecticide and pesticides that you put on. That it's kind of like, think of it like a really, really, really high-powered front line that you use on a cat and dog. Well, there's a stuff called ivermectin that you use on cows. You just pour it down their spine, and it absorbs into their body. Well, you can't do that with dairy cattle or beef cattle because it absorbs into the flesh and the blood and so on, and now it's no longer organic. So they just have to suffer with, you know, the problems with parasites and flies and infections and other medical maladies because you can't give them any drugs.
Wow, that's amazing. So the organic, and they suffer in a whole variety of ways that we wouldn't even think of, and the average person would never even dream of, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And it's covered over. I want to see if anyone has any questions. So, you know, if you have a question for Harold, please press, Steve, it's star 2, I believe. Press star 2 on your phone, and then you'll be able to see it here on our computer screen, and we can unmute your phone and you can ask him a question. There is one question that came in, or you can type it in if you're online, you know, if you have access to the computer, just type it in there if you have a question for Harold. I'll read one that we have from a woman who's in Ireland. She's on in our group and will be a facilitator. And her question is, Ireland has a large meat and dairy industry. What advice would you give an animal advocate like me when speaking to farmers and other employees of these industries who feel that I threaten their livelihoods?
Wow, well, that's the work I do. And
you do that. You're the perfect person to ask this because you do that all the time.
Well, the big challenge there is that I have a definite advantage in doing that, and I'm not saying that to toot my own horn, but it really does help if you can talk the lingo, if you know what they do, what they're, you know, kind of, you know, talk the talk and walk the walk, and it's, but that helps, but it's not absolutely necessary. At the very gross level of how you deal with this is that, you know, basically it's the challenge of gently suggesting to them that, you know, saying something like, you know, you're a very talented farmer, you're able to grow food, you're able to do things that most, you know, that 99% of Americans have no concept on how to do, and, you know, or even know where to begin in producing food. But are you saying you only know how to do one thing? You know, and it's like, and the way I always approach this is that, you know, if you've got an investment portfolio, do you put all of your money into one thing and expect to make money over the long term? No. And any good farm, and especially now with, you know, with the boom of CSAs and organic farms and so on, the very core thing you build upon is diversification. You know, you don't have just a lettuce CSA. You don't have just a beet CSA or a potato CSA. You know, any good CSA that's going to survive over time and make money, or any farm, is one that is, you know, highly diversified because it's better for the environment, it's better for the soil, but it also covers your short and long-term risks when it comes to weather and a number of other factors. So that is the one thing that you bring up is, can you, you know, you could do something else, you know. Sure, you might, the other way to think of it, and from their point of view, is that they're like a factory. We've monocultured our world to death. And I mean that literally, to death. And the thing is that most farmers recognize that. They know that, you know, this isn't a sustainable way of doing things, but it's like building a car in a factory. Like you go, I grew up in Michigan, so I know the car business very well, but you have a factory that's building a minivan, and it builds that one kind of minivan. There's variations on that minivan, but it's tooled to do that. But then if you're going to build a car the next year, then they shut that factory down for the summer usually. It's usually 2 to 3 months to retool the factory. Well, that's what a farmer does. They're invested their machinery into, they're tooled to do a specific thing because of monoculturing. And what they need to do is how do we do this? Now, one of my arguments is that, you know, is to try to find some sort of justice in our food production system in that, in, you know, that we make it, incentivize farmers to go toward plant-based agriculture by subsidizing them to do that, and which
right.
means that part of that subsidy program would be to help them retool how to, you know, buy, they probably already have the tractors, but, you know, to buy, you know, chisel plows or whatever else they need to get themselves set up into doing a more diversified means of agriculture. And also to part of this dialogue, really the onus is on us to educate ourselves. And that is to grab some books, some textbooks and stuff, and read up on how agriculture works in the United States. How does the subsidy system work? How is our really messed up commodity system work in this country? And you'll find out that everything is skewed toward corporate agriculture. I mean,
right.
big time. And it's like, how do we, you wouldn't get a farmer that isn't going to argue with you about that the system is broke. They've complained about, my grandfather complained about it, that the system was broke, you know, 50 years ago. Well, to this day, they are still griping. Even the big guys are griping about it because it's just such an inequity in how wealth is distributed in that system. And if we can learn about how that system works and that what would be a better way of doing it, and also understanding the biological means of production when it comes to animal products, in that everything in agriculture is measured, like farmers are not, you know, a bunch of dumb sod busters anymore. Everybody works on a business management system. They're all computerized. I mean, Craig, my brother's farm now, they both for planting and harvesting, they have GPS operated tractors. And they go out there and they go out and they plant. The guy gets off. He programs the tractor in for the field. He maps the field only once. Goes out, sets up the tractor. Goes out, it plows and plants at the same time, and he goes and sleeps in his truck. It only takes him a few hours to 100 acres, a couple hours to 100 acres, and then comes back when it's harvest time with the combine, same thing, sets it up, you know, plugs in his GPS map for that field, and he goes in the truck and takes a nap while the combine's out there with nobody in it doing the work. That's how highly automated this is getting. And when we understand these things, but they measure everything. Everything is measured in kilocalories. It's all about inputs, outputs. How many kilocalories go in, whether it's fuel, labor, the rubber on the tire, on the equipment, you name it. Everything is considered as far as the inputs go. And then the outputs, you look at how many kilocalories are coming out, whether it's consumable food or what I call virtual kilocalories, the things that are embedded in the product, such as water and so on and so forth. That's all taken into consideration. And when you can talk that way with them and talk about the biology of what's going on, is for all the things that I have problems with Michael Pollan, this he understands. and it's something like in Botany of Desire, you can really take away from that book is that the amount of kilocalories that goes into raising any kind of and creating any kind of animal product is so inefficient for what it took to put into it to what you get out the other end. And
right.
Literally, when you look at it that way, all you're doing, all any farmer is doing that is creating animal products, producing animal products, is feeding an addiction, because there's no other rational explanation for wasting this much energy and these many resources to produce something that is so heavily subsidized to make it profitable, other than you're feeding an addiction. It isn't any different than being hooked on morphine or cocaine or crack, you know,
right.
Heroin. It's all the same.
Right.
So well, getting back to that, the discussion is again, it's kind of you listen to their story. That's what I do. I listen to their story and see where they're at, and just say, okay, they may be really concerned about the changes they've seen in the, you know, the environment of their farm. It might be what they're really griping about is the, you know, the literal nuts and bolts of the commodity system. Or it might be that they're literally having a, you know, a conflict of conscience about what they do to animals if they're an animal farmer. And, you know, I'm dealing with somebody right now that I think I've got her, this will be the last year she has a beef operation not too far from here, and she's certified organic grass-fed beef, but I think this is going to be her last year, her last calving season, because she keeps observing things. It's been 3 years and since I've met Kathy, and when she shares things with me, I just listen, and she says, well, you've been around cattle a lot more than me. What do you think this means? I said, well, what do you think it means? Because she needs to own the story. She needs to own her own observations. And I just say, well, you know, and yeah, they have community. You know, they, you know, when you've seen three cows standing there munching their cud, watching the 15 calves, which are all grouped together, she says, where are the other cows? Well, they're out eating, so they can produce milk without being bothered by their babies. I said, those are the babysitters. And then another observation a year later was that she finally realized that the hierarchy of a herd is matriarchal. And she, would share, a funny story about that. But these things are just pieces of a puzzle that she's putting together. But you have to understand that when people make these observations of the sentience of farm animals, they do it begrudgingly, because they don't want to admit to what they're witnessing, but they can't
right.
help but make the observation. And all you have to do is be present for them and say, yeah, you know, I could understand that. I know how I would feel if I was, you know, a mom and my baby was taken away or, whatever. But the main thing is to nurture them in their journey. It's not to say,
right.
well, you know, I've read this book. I said, you know, I think it ought to be this. You know, don't ever use the I think thing, because that turns people right off. It's nurturing them on their journey and asking, you know, just being present with them, and then having them own what they're experiencing in an emotionally honest way, and being absolutely emotionally honest yourself, and laying aside your judgments, laying aside your own ego for a moment, and just be there with them and see where it goes. And sometimes it goes in astonishing places.
Mm-hmm. Great. Wow, that's interesting. Thanks. There's some more questions have come in here. The comment, I'll just give you the comment, and then maybe a question from Kyle. Dr. Neil Bernard and the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine is lobbying to eliminate government farm subsidies for the meat and dairy industry. So yeah, we're all aware that there's a lot of, not just them, a lot of people are lobbying to reduce these insane subsidies for the meat and dairy industry, which is obviously really bad for the environment and health and everything else. And that would change things. So that's something we can do. It can be done at the sort of political level that I think would probably reduce the amount of consumption like if you're, you know, subsidizing addiction, it makes it easier for people to continue with it. And then there's a question here from someone in Australia. Hi, Harold. Given the approach to activism that you've discussed, how important are films like Earthlings and Peaceful Kingdom in the scheme of things? They certainly place a spotlight on the cruelty inflicted on animals.
Yeah, that's a good one. This is something I've been struggling with for a while. You know, I've seen a lot of these things. These videos are coming out, and more of them are coming out all the time now. And I'm of two minds on this right now. But when it comes to these videos, I lump them into two categories. The vast majority of the videos that have been done for years and are still being done that expose the overt cruelty of animals is, I don't know how useful those are. I mean, how many more years, how many more times do we have to keep showing the same thing? There's nothing new under the sun. I mean, what gets exposed last week isn't any different than what was done 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Excuse me, it's all the same. And it's, again, it comes back to that thing about human nature. Are these the things that the general public are going to say and go, oh, well, I'm going to change what I'm doing 180 degrees. No. People shut their eyes. They may witness it, but it's hardly ever contextualized in a way that gives them hope. How many of these videos do you watch, and then when you walk away from it, you have hope? And that is the problem. I put that where I put most of these videos in what I call the shock and awe category. They do shock people, and it upsets them, and very few people can watch one all the way through. And even for some activists who've seen quite a bit, some of these things they just can't watch. And for some people, it shuts them down completely. I mean, I've had that experience myself. Last year, I had that experience with a particular undercover thing. It was done in Ohio. But the reason it shut me down was because this guy that they videotaped and tried to prosecute, I used to do some of those same things. And it opened doors in me and forced me to relive some stuff in my life that I just didn't want to relive. But nevertheless, there it is. The other category I have for these videos is what I call the inspirational, the transformational videos. And I think the work Tribe of Heart does, and possibly, I might put Earthlings in there too, but again, it focuses a little bit too much on the overt cruelty, and the message of hope is not a real takeaway for a lot of people, but it's there. I mean, the message is there, but I think it's overwhelmed at times by the images. But the thing is you have to give people a reason to make a change. They have to they have to see the injustice and not walk away as one of the parameters. A friend of mine, Ray Sikora, said that the only films that she finds useful are the ones that she can walk away and after she's watched it, said, I don't hate human beings. Because so many of these things you watch and you say, I hate humans. You know, we're a plague upon this planet. Well, unfortunately, we may be, but the point is we're here. And what are we going to do? What are our choices going to be? And I think it's important that we have videos that support and nurture that. What's going to be the new story? I think everybody, if you're going to have a scale of 0 to 100 in your activism, I think 1% of it should be exposing people to those videos, if they can handle it. And because everybody needs to see the wizard behind the curtain. But the rest of that time, that 99% of your activism has to be in the practice of mindful compassion and joy and love and advocating for justice and speaking the truth. And not speaking truth power, but speaking the truth to each other. And that is where the change is going to happen. So I'm This is kind of a stream of consciousness thing I'm kind of going on here, but I don't know how useful these videos are anymore, and I don't think that if they were so good, they've been around for so long, how come more people haven't changed? Because they're making the 6 o'clock news now. Well, they have for a number of years, but we haven't seen a sea change in how people consider, you know, farm animals. So, yeah, okay, there it is. It's not, I can't. That's kind of not fully formed, but that's what I'm thinking.
Right, right. I understand. Great. And then one other question that came in. How can we further the future of veganic agriculture? Also, and then the second question is also, what do you see as the future of organic agriculture, especially in the light of GMOs, possibly allowing GMOs in organic produce? I haven't heard that yet. That's ridiculous. GMOs shouldn't be in organic produce. But, yeah, maybe I was thinking it would be nice if you could say a few words about veganic agriculture, because I think if most people are aware, even if you're a vegan and you're buying organic or commercial, but, you know, we try to buy organic, there's all these animal inputs, bone meal and blood meal and manure and all this stuff going into the production of the kale and everything else. And it would be much better if we could grow our food without animal inputs. And I know you've done quite a bit of research on this. So if you could give maybe, you know, we've taken a lot of time here. So I think we should probably begin to wrap up. I know it's getting late where you are on the East Coast. Maybe give us a few minutes on that and kind of wrap it up here.
Okay. Well, really, I would say the best thing anybody can do is get there's only one book out there on veganic or what they call stock-free organic techniques. It's a book called Growing Green, and read that book. It's a little bit to plow through in parts, especially if you're not familiar with agriculture, but get through it so you can knowledgeably speak to people about it, or even organic farmers. I've got a friend who lives in this area who's been doing his own trial and error veganic farming for 20 some odd years, and he's the only one in the area. And when he tries to share his knowledge with other organic farmers, permaculture, biodynamic, whatever it might be, it's like the way Bill puts it is that he thinks that some people are only capable of one quantum leap in their lifetime. It's like they looked at chemical agriculture, and then now they're doing organic, and they pat themselves on the back and said, you know, I'm home. Well, no, you can take another step. And it is the hope, it is the future of food production in the world, but it's the only hope we have for, you know, conserving fresh water and so on and so forth. And also cutting down our risk for exposure to everything from brain parasites to mad cow disease to, you know, further exposure to other pathogens. You know, we always hear about these E. coli and salmonella contaminated vegetables, you know, lettuces and sprouts and whatever it might be. That's not the fault of the plant, because these are zoonotic diseases. They come from the animal kingdom. And
right.
And it's what they're using in the field, what they're watering the field with. It could be in the aquifer.
Right.
You know, it's really problematic. So this is the future. And there is a movement internationally to develop, especially in North America, between Canada and the United States. There's a group of activists who are working to set up a veganic certification system that will be free, because there's a lot of people growing organically, but they can't afford to pay the fees to the third-party certification organizations. So we're looking at making something that's going to be free, but it's going to set a standard which is going to be much higher than organic standards, and you know, it will be. And the thing is you can grow more food. I don't care what you're talking about. What, you know, I've seen and read that. I've read the data. I've seen it actually happen, and I've experimented with it with myself in my own little garden. In that you can grow more food using veganic practices than you can with any other form of sustainable agriculture. You can use
that wonderful news. I mean, the permaculturists should really embrace this if this is true, rather than say you've got to have hens and eggs and fish and manure and great. That's really wonderful news. You know, I think we're going to have to wrap it up here, Harold. It's been absolutely great. I feel like we've just gotten, you know, a little glimpse into the vast knowledge you have about agriculture and animal agriculture and veganism and spreading the message. And people have had a chance to ask some questions. Are there any last-minute questions? I'm looking to see if anybody put star two on. I think we'll get those. That was great. We had those questions, and we can continue to talk about some of these things on the forums. The book that he's recommending for veganics is called Growing Green, and you can get it at Amazon and other places. And so I guess with that, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been really fantastic. And we wish you all the best. Do you have any last-minute thoughts, or do you feel pretty complete?
Well, yeah, and I would just invite anybody who has, you know, further questions or thoughts or comments. They can contact me through my website, which is farmkind.org, and my personal email is there, and also my cell phone number. So I'd be happy to talk with anybody about, you know, the challenges they're facing or any information they might be looking for.
Right. Yeah, and also in your outreach, wherever you are, I recommend obviously having Harold come to speak to a group. If you have a college in the area, he's really great at speaking to colleges, especially if it's a land-grant college or a vegetarian or vegan group. It's really a great resource that we have with Harold. So thanks so much. Really great to have you with us on the call.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been my honor and pleasure.
Great. All right. Thanks again. We'll talk to you later. All right. Well, that was, I think a huge amount of information there and a lot more where that comes from. So if anyone wants to talk more with Harold, feel free to contact him. He's very approachable, very humble, and has a lot of experience in this whole thing from both sides. And so I'd like to, we've already gone now for about an hour, and we have, we want to always end by half past, go for an hour and a half. So we don't have that much more time. I wanted to just mention a couple of things, and we have a few people I think also we could maybe hear from that are with us now too. But I just wanted to mention that there's going to be some things in your online there you can see. One, the main one is the July 2011 World Peace Diet Facilitator Circle resources list. And I won't go over it, but it's there. There's lots of some of the things in the last month that have come up. There's been lots of activity in the world of just talking about health and animal agriculture and meat and so forth. So there's quite a few links to articles, some really interesting things, lots of interesting things. The cruelty that's being exposed in dairy, pig and hen operations here and also in other parts of the world, and music that's coming out and health things that are coming out and all kinds of things. I mean, it's really a lot to keep up with, but it's important, I think, to keep up with this. And I really agree with Harold when he said the importance of having our movement be something where we're not sort of wagging our fingers and blaming people, but we're inviting them to join the party, basically, that we can be much healthier. And there's nothing better, really, than being healthy and having inner peace and having our relationships be more harmonious. It's not easy being a vegan in our culture. That's part of the challenge of that, but that's why it's important, I think, that we do the best we can to create vegan community, as our friend and colleague Mark Stroud has been doing in a variety of ways. And I think Mark is, Mark is with us. Here he is. Oh, he's got his hand up too. Great. Okay, Mark, you're there. Hi, Mark. I'd like to, if so great to, that you're with us on the call. Would you like to, I think most people know that you're from Cincinnati, that you've been really pioneering the World Peace Diet, facilitator, having study groups there, and combining this whole thing of health and compassion with yoga and spirituality. And I was wondering if you have any news to share with us this month, or any thoughts or insights.
Well, am I connected? Am I on the call here?
You sounds good. Can hear you.
Okay, good. Yeah, well, great to be here, Will. And great to be with Harold. Harold is, I just have to share that it was the World Peace and Yoga Jubilee in Loveland, Ohio. And for me, when Harold spoke year before last, that was the most poignant movement moment for me at the Jubilee. When Harold spoke and talked about his treatment of farm animals, and hearing it from him in particular was just really powerful. Really powerful. I was couldn't hold back the tears at that point in time.
Right.
The Jubilee in itself was just a really powerful experience. But to hear Harold talk about his truth and his humility, and that he had been responsible for the death of so many beings on this planet, that so to hear him again tonight reminded me of that experience, and just how powerful a voice he is for change on the planet right now, and
right.
for the realization of how we as human animals have the ability to shift and to change our attitude and to create a different world where all beings are respected and revered and appreciated for all their unique talents and abilities and their just simple existence on this planet. So really great to hear from Harold, who has such a depth of knowledge. I mean, it's really interesting to me because where we all participate in this experience because we're eating the bodies of other animals secondhand, because we always have our agents, and Harold was one of our agents who actually was out there on the front line growing and then managing and then murdering the animals that we then ate. So his knowledge and his depth of experience that he brings to all of us is so intimate and so powerful. I just deeply appreciate it. So and I'd like to extend an invitation to Harold to speak at the World Peace and Yoga Jubilee this year in October 20th through the 24th. Love for him to join you, of course, Will, and Julia Hill, and all the others that it's been said by quite a few that whether it's a yoga journal conference or whether it's an animal rights conference, that the Jubilee really is one of the few, if not the only, gathering of people from across the country, really from across the world, where spirituality is embodied in the conversation and in this change. And as Harold said, it's not legislation that's going to change things. it wasn't the Emancipation Proclamation or Abraham Lincoln or that freed the slaves. There's actually statistically more slaves in the United States now than there were in the 1800s. And it's because it's not a legislative consideration. The laws, we have laws against stealing, we have laws against murdering, and that happens on a daily basis. So I really invite people to come to the Jubilee because it's a forum where we can express the integrity and the morality that's necessary to change things so that there's a respect and an appreciation and an endorsement of empathy for all beings from the heart.
Great, yeah,
so,
it's a wonderful thing, and I'll be giving another World Peace Type Facilitator training, a live one. So if you know anyone who would like to go through that, or like to yourself, Madeline and I will be there the third week in October in Cincinnati, outside Cincinnati. That's definitely an opportunity to find out more about. And then also we've got something opening up in California, in Healdsburg, of all places, in Healdsburg, where we used to live for several years. And Mark is intimately involved with that whole thing, too. So can you tell us a little bit about what's happening in Healdsburg?
Yeah, Healdsburg, California.
It's up in the wine country.
A little bit, about
an hour
and
a half north of,
San Francisco, depending on traffic, of course. And just a beautiful town, and there's now a World Peace Diet Center, World Peace Yoga Studio is now operating in Healdsburg, and so it's a great opportunity for people on the West Coast to come together. There's a World Peace Diet Study Group that's going on there now, and potlucks. We're going to have the first speaker program in August, I think August 22nd. Which is the kickoff will be with Will speaking and there in Healdsburg. And then on a regular basis, we'll have speakers coming in, classes, study group, vegan potlucks. So anybody who's in that area is welcome. Please come and visit 111 Mill Street in Healdsburg. And yeah, it's just really great to see things expanding and more and more people getting on board with integrity and recognizing their humility and morality to basically create heaven on earth here, where there's a reverence for all beings, the planet, for each other, and it's happening in Healdsburg, and also Dr. Michael Clapper, who has a vegan clinic, basically a vegan hospital in Santa Rosa, which is 15 minutes from Healdsburg, will be coming to speak as well shortly, and he's a real pioneer in the vegan world and as a physician, so we're really honored that he's going to come and speak at the studio in Healdsburg.
Yeah, it's great. We've got Loveland in Cincinnati and Healdsburg in California.
Yeah, one thing I learned about Healdsburg is that Healdsburg was founded by a man from Ohio. His last name was Heald, consequently Healdsburg, and he was also a vegetarian.
Oh, really? That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good. Wow, that's great. So, yeah, please stay in touch with us if you want to be involved in that in some way, if you want to teach, or, you know, we see that as expanding and opening doorways in Northern California. So please stay in touch with us about that and also, of course, about the Jubilee in Cincinnati coming up in October. That's a powerful time for us to get together as well. So thanks, Mark. That's pretty much it, I think. Is there anything else? Or?
Yeah, just to reiterate that the Jubilee is just a real special time to get together with Will and Madeline and to experience facilitator training, rubbing elbows shoulder to shoulder, and that there will be four days of peace, yoga, food, and music, 4 days to spend intimately with Will and Madeline. It's an experience like no other.
Mm. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, just Google Will Peace Yoga Jubilee. Okay, you'll get right to it. So, all right, well, good. Thanks so much, Mark. Appreciate hearing from you and all you're doing, you and Anna, and everything that's happening in Healdsburg. We've had some real magical synchronicities and openings there that I think bode very well for the future of the vegan movement.
Yes.
Okay. Great. All right. So, well, it's getting a little bit late here. I want to just let everybody know that next month we've been trying to do this on the third Thursday of the month typically, and this month we went later because I was in Switzerland, which was really interesting. I spoke actually in Germany. In Italy, and very interesting, I think it's probably one of the largest intentional communities in the world. They had their own currency. It's very spiritual. It's called Damanhur. I highly recommend you looking into it. And they're pretty vegetarian friendly, but they're not, and vegan friendly actually, but they're not there yet. And so I gave a lecture and sold some books and got the conversation going, hopefully some more. In northern Italy there at Damanhur, really amazing creative place. And then, of course, being in Switzerland, the dairy is really extremely well established there. Vegetarian is pretty easy, but vegan is something that they can't even imagine. But anyway, so because of that, we were 1 week later. But next month in August will be the third week, which is the 25th. Of August, and we'll have with us Dr. Melanie Joy, who wrote a book and she works quite a bit with Unitarians and also just in general with the Animal Rights Conference too. I don't remember the exact title of the book, but why we eat cows and wear pigs and pet dogs and so forth. She's the one who coined the term carnism. Wonderful scholar, great person. We look forward to having her with us on that call. And then the third week in September, which is the 15th, we'll be having Colleen Patrick Goudreau on the call with us. And both of these people are really also, like Carol, very brilliant vegans who are really pioneering a lot of the best things that are happening in our movement, bringing spirituality and joy and compassion and creativity into the way that we live our lives and the way we spread the message. So it's just really wonderful to be with you folks and working together and keeping the spirit moving forward. We have more people joining up and taking the trainings online now, and so please do stay in touch with us if you have any questions about anything having to do with spreading the vegan message. This is a time for us also just if we have, and sometimes in the church services I go to, they have a time for joys and concerns, which they call it joys and concerns sharing. But basically the idea is to share any ideas we have, either great ideas, things that work, things that have happened that have helped, been inspirational to us, or any concerns we have, any problems, difficulties. And I always like to have this opportunity. So, if, you know, please press star 2 or type it in if you have a joy or concern or something you'd like to share with the group. And also, I know that, notice that our wonderful friend Tara is on the call, and I was just thought I'd check in with Tara. If you would like to say a few words, I know you were at the Animal Rights Conference, and you've been just helping so much with, you know, getting, she's been, now Tara's been helping us get the Veg Inspiration for the Day out every day. Hope you're all getting that. Go to worldpeacediet.com, and you can sign up, or you can just see it there every day and have it come in. It's a free service. So, Tara, do you have anything?
Hi.
You there? Yes, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly.
Okay, good, good. Hi, how are you? Welcome back to the United States.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, let's see. What my joys? The joys that for me, the last month feels like actually about 3 months, I think. We were fortunate to welcome Will to Southern California at the end of June. And for me, besides meeting Will and Madeline in person for the first time and experiencing hearing both of them speak in a group and amongst friends and making new friends is the incredible cross-pollination of intention in groups and the respect and the skill building that's building between organizations in this area. So people I've met through the World Peace Diet, and, you know, that has expanded. And it really, that's where the fertile soil began for me, was reading the book and then getting involved with facilitator training. That's expanded to tabling and getting to know other organizations, Compassion Over Killing, Animal Protection and Rescue League, Orange County Raw and Living. All of these groups got together to welcome Will to Southern California. Vegan Toastmasters. We just completed the Animal Rights Conference here in Los Angeles, which was my first attendance there. Vegan Toastmasters
Great.
Was there too. And it's just been incredibly fun. I attended a talk by Nick Cooney last evening, and that was really interesting because he's compiled a lot of information about effective ways to be an activist and in some ways in alignment with what the interesting things that Harold had to say too. And, you know, in one room we've got people from that are World Peace Diet facilitators and Vegan Toastmasters and from the other groups that I've seen and met in other places. And we're all just gathering together, and there's a strength and solidarity that's building that's really, really fun.
Great. Well, that's very interesting. I want to sort of just follow up with that. The talks that I gave earlier, like a month, whatever it was, 3 or 4 weeks ago, it was terrific to see all these different, you know, the peace groups that really, really weren't vegetarian oriented, but were interested in peace, and how we were able to bring the message there, and then how Compassion Over Killing and some of the other, you know, vegan restaurants and some of the angles to bring in the message. People also, you know, just eating good vegan food, I think, is a really important part of it. And Tara, I think, is a wonderful example of someone who's making these connections between groups and cross-fertilization and working together. And I think that's a great way to spread the message and reinvigorate and make new connections and build things up. And Mark has also been doing that too. I think a lot of people are doing that, but Tara is a great example. So thank you so much for that example and for what you're doing. And also I just want to mention that I'll be speaking some more in California, in Monterey. One of our facilitators is putting on a talk there in August, and also in San Francisco, and then, of course, up in Healdsburg as well, and then down in Los Angeles is also, I'll be speaking at the Loving Hut in Claremont. That's coming up the end of August, and another place in Light, I think it's called Lightwood or something. Anyway, so it's a really, if anyone, you know, wants to have me come and speak somewhere where you are, Madeline and I are traveling around in the RV again, and so we'll be available for that. And I also wanted to mention one other thing. If you are interested at all in attending this big event that's going to be, I think it's the 5-year celebration of Supreme Master TV, Don McLean, who some of you may remember, who wrote American Pie and so forth, he's going to be a musician there, and plus a lot of other famous Los Angeles or Hollywood musicians. They're doing they're putting a lot of Supreme Master Ching Hai's poetry and music. It's going to be a totally vegan event with a big vegan feast. The tickets are, I think, around $50, but they've told me that I can bring in, you know, anyone who would like to go can have a free ticket. If you just let me know you're interested, and I can save you a place. So just let me know. That's going to be on July, that's going to be on August 27th, Saturday evening in Pasadena. So it should be a wonderful event, and let me know if you're interested in that. So let's see, is there anything else, Tara, you wanted to mention? I think you're all set?
No, I'm good. I'm good. I'm fine.
Good. All right. No, great.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Yeah. All right. So I think we are in the mode here of kind of wrapping up. if anyone has anything else, you know, in the next couple of minutes, if you'd like to share something, just raise, press star 2. The final things from on my plate here, I guess, just to draw your attention. Steve will be putting up, I think, a few articles that I've chosen that I think are interesting. You can see them in the membership site at some point in the next few days. One about the chemicals in milk, which, go ahead.
They're there now, Will. So
are they there now? Oh, great. Yeah. Wow. Fantastic. Okay. Thank you so much, Steve. So they're there already. One on the chemicals in milk, besides the it's very important, I think, to be aware that besides all of the drugs and things that end up in milk, there's also 59 naturally occurring chemicals that are basically drugs that are in milk as well. And so, you know, more to understand. There's always more to learn. That's one of the things that inspires me, actually, about Harold Brown, who's been in this for so many years as a farmer and so forth, but he also stays up to date on everything. I think it's really helpful to do that. So I have some things there that you can look at. One is on Christianity. One is on the Egyptian mummies. Very interesting article about how the wealthy pharaohs ate diets very high in animal foods because they were the rich elite, and how their scientists have discovered that they had serious heart disease and atherosclerosis, and it's not surprising. And a nice article by Kathy Freston on veganism in children, and then an article I wrote on global warming thing and how they're killing camels in Australia to prevent global warming while growing literally many times more cows and so forth, and the sort of insanity of that whole thing. So we have lots to learn, lots to share, and I want to just close, I guess, now, since we've been on the call here for really our full allotted time, by just thanking all of you again for continuing to make the efforts that you're making to encourage us to continue to stay in touch during the month. And thank you, Steve, for making it easier for us to do that. The forums are more efficient now. You also, when you post something to the forums, you will be receiving an email when someone else posts something. So I think that's really helpful and encourages our interaction on the forums. And please let us know, share your ideas about study groups and anything that you would like to do to help spread the vegan message. We want to support you in that, and also to, you know, making a living. Some of you are finding ways to do that, or to, there's no reason if you're putting a lot of work into this, you're not reimbursed for it. I think that's something we want to explore more as well. But the main thing is to continue to plant the seeds and to hold the vision of a world where we live in harmony with each other, with the animals who are so beautiful and such amazing expressions of life, and where we human beings free ourselves from the violence of eating animals and seeing them really as things. The World Peace Diet is continuing to be translated into other languages. The second form of Chinese is just coming on right now, and I've been invited to speak in places kind of far away, like Slovenia and Croatia recently, as well as I think Bosnia, Serbia. So we'll see. It's exciting to see the message getting out there in lots of different ways, and so we just close our time by giving thanks for this opportunity that we've had. Please continue to make the efforts and enjoy the wonderful possibilities that enter our lives as we embrace compassion, that our thinking and our thoughts and our own spiritual unfoldment are very, very powerful. And to stay positive, to stay focused on the beauty of the world, and that we can transform our world. So much love to you all, and let's stay in touch. We'll look forward to talking again on the next call, which will be the Thursday, the 25th of August. Much love to you all. Thanks again.